The problem is that the modern economy didn't grow out of markets, but grew out of fairs, of the fairground. Training an elite in our own times, it's a very delicate kind of activity of what we really mean by that. And Pascal said, the heart has its reasons, which reason cannot understand.
Welcome to No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium, St. Gallen, Switzerland. My name is Wolfram Eilenberger, your host for this season. Welcome, friends of freedom, to No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium. Eight great minds, one important question. Our question for this year is, what is freedom? Who threatens it? And how we can defend it in the 21st century? Today's guest is Arpad Szakoszlai. He is the Hilti Fellow of the St. Gallen Collegium. He taught for more than 20 years as a professor of sociology at the University of Cork. He has a PhD for economics at the University of Texas. And his topic for this year is freedom beyond liberalism. Welcome to the podcast, Arpad. Let's start with the present moment, with today. Today is the 11th month and the 11th day. It is 11 o'clock and I'm not making this up. 11 minutes. A very special time starts now. It's called the Carnival. A time of unparalleled freedom. Arpad, you are an anthropologist. What is this thing with Carnival? Why does it even exist?
Well, the Carnival exists in many different ways, historically and contemporaneously. The Carnival is supposed to be a time of suspense, a time of out of the ordinary, a time in which people do the opposite what they do normally, a time to break the rules, a time when it is allowed to break the rules, and when, of course, it doesn't really matter, because if you are encouraged to break the rules, that's not really the breaking of the rules. So that's part of the ambivalence of Carnival, which is analyzed so well, among others, by Mikhail Bakhtin, whom you certainly know well, and who was a great figure of intellectual history. So Carnival has its historical and anthropological elements as well.
And would it be fair to say that Carnival is a genuine expression of the human longing for freedom?
Well, it might be the case, but it's an indication. And here I'm talking about Carnival, not just specifically the modern sense of the Carnival, but the medieval sense of the Carnival, and again the similar kind of rituals that existed all the times. And just concerning the European tradition, it goes back to the Saturnalias of Rome, and that's the rule of Saturn, and Saturn is a very particular kind of deity, and actually we don't even know exactly what it all means. The Saturn, it goes back to the Greek satyr place, and that is, you know, historians or whatever, philologues still don't agree whether there are connections between the Greek satyr players and the Roman Saturnalias, etymologically or historically, so it's a very broad phenomenon.
And it's also a time where the fools reign, where the fools have all the power and the kings are powerless. It's a time where the world is turned on its head. It's almost like a revolution.
Well, it's exactly the point. It's supposedly a world turned upside down. And that applies to the Carnival. That also applies to the comedy. Historians and theoreticians of the comedy describe the comedy as it is a world turned upside down. And it has important contemporary relevance because in our age, actors, and not just actors, but comedians in several countries play political role, which is an indication of a world turned upside down.
It's interesting when you, for example, watch TV nowadays, you could also have the impression that the fools reign, that the satire is everywhere, that irony is everywhere. It's like we're living in an eternal carnival sometimes, it seems.
Yes, that it is. I mean, that's what I wrote about the permanent carnival, permanent liminality. And the carnival also has links to sacrifice, which makes it even more paradoxical. Even the Saturnalias in Rome were connected to some kind of sacrifices. And I call this permanent carnival of ours as a kind of sacrificial carnival. Bakhtin is very important here.
The Russian cultural theory guy, Mikhail Bakhtin.
Exactly, because Bakhtin lived in the Soviet Union and he wrote his book in the Soviet Union. And the Soviet Union was, again, a place of a permanent kind of sacrificial carnival, because it was partly sacrificial, partly carnivalesque, very absurd, but when the absurd was real and reality was absurd, so it's a...
Now we are already in the midst of the fascinating turns and twists you can give to cultural history. You would say that the Stalinism, as we know them, as we know it and as we remember it, was kind of a carnival where the population was sacrificed for an idea?
It was something like that. Everything about this was highly absurd, but it was only highly comedic. Now, it was quite some time ago, and I don't remember, 8 or 10 years ago, but a Scottish filmmaker made a film about Stalin, exactly in this kind of sense, that it was awful and terrible and terrifying, but at the same time, it was comic. And this was a kind of permanent reality for those living in those times. And I mean, I was born in 58, so I didn't live
in Hungary.
In Hungary. So I didn't live in the first times, but I had some recollections or, you know, family, people around historically, and what the reality in which I was growing into in the 1960s was still pretty much a kind of very grim Soviet reality, but which is also absurd at every level.
Absurd, terribly comical.
Yes,
exactly. Abysmal in many ways. And one of the hallmarks of Stalinism and the Soviet World War was the aim to create a new human being, the new human, to remake humanity. And that brings us to your discipline, which is anthropology, political anthropology. First of all, the question of anthropology, what is it? Is it the question, what is a human being and why are humans different from any other kind of species?
Yes, but that's a very important question. I must say something before, because what I'm doing, I call now political anthropology, but actually I'm an emeritus professor of sociology, so I was a professor of sociology for 23 years or so.
Teaching in Ireland, mainly?
In Ireland, but before then that I have a PhD in economics from the University of Texas, so many people would be upset if I call myself an anthropologist, but that's part of the thing which I'm doing. And certainly this question of, you know, what does it to be human, is a very fundamental question, and it goes into the heart of sociology, anthropology, even philosophy. I mean, that was the question of Kant's lectures, and this is what Michel Foucault wrote his minor thesis on in the early, very early 1960s.
So it's not one of the most important questions, it's possibly the most important question.
In a certain way, of course, because we are all human, we are human beings, and we have to understand what it takes to be a human being. And of course, a human being is not just an isolated human being, because a human being without language is not a human being, and a language is not a private language, as we know. So it's also a social and political question. And it's also a very contemporary question. If you only look into technology and AI and what does this do to us? How does it alter or at least threaten our very humanity?
And of course, the social sciences and the humanities are in the business of giving answers to that very question. And several answers have been given. For example, there's the idea that we are homo economicus, that we are an economical being. There's an idea that we are homo ludens, that we are playful beings. There's the idea that we are homo symbolicum, that we are symbol-using animals. What is the answer, if there is any, that you prefer to that question?
Well, it's an interesting question, because I don't like to give this kind of quick answers. And the basic point is that all of these answers capture one element of that. I mean, you did mention the homo faber, which was also a very famous kind of response.
The tool-using animal.
Very partial. And there is also the response of Tim Ingold, who is one of the most famous, most important anthropologists of our times and of all times, which is, I can't remember the Latin version of that, which is the Volking man, so the homo
laborans,
viatore.
Maybe.
Yes, it's homo viatore. So it's and actually the homo viatore for me is the maybe the most closest to the real thing. The viatore in the sense of walking, in the sense of being on the road. And this is Ingold, but this is also a kind of Heideggerian response about the road. It's a very Greek response about metahodos, and then we are back into even into method, because the very word method is Greek, and metahodos means according to or alongside the way or the road. So method doesn't mean that you have to follow the scientific, you know, method or the rules, but you have to somehow find a way and follow the way, and that is very human.
To find your way and to follow the way, that's one way to talk about freedom. And maybe one way to define the human being is also it's a life form that seeks freedom, that has the longing for freedom, that urges to be free. Would you say that this is a possible answer too, that we are beings that long to be free?
That is absolutely the case, but then we have to be very careful if what we mean by this kind of freedom, because just to go back to the question of technology, which is, you know, walking free means that you don't have obstacles all the way. And with technology, you have obstacles all around. I mean, we did four pilgrimages with Agnes through Europe.
Your wife, Agnes.
With my wife, Agnes Horváth, wife and co-author, yes, and mentor, yes, and everything.
Your intellectual counterpart, you could say.
Well, counterpart, but not in the sense of contra, but in the sense of conversational mm-hmm. partner, yes. So we did four walking tours, and they were really eye-opening in a kind of way, because this is when we realized somehow the untenability and the utter corruptness of the entire world in which we live in. Because on the one hand, we were continuously encountering obstacles in terms of walking. And also we, you know, the walking meant that we walked through nature.
Walking, not working, walking. Just to make that clear. Yes.
We walked through nature, walking. We walked through culture, and then we walked through modernity. When it was a modern city, when it was a railroad track, or when it was an enormous highway intersection, and how can you walk through an intersection of interstate highways and so on. And
so your idea is that technology essentially is blocking our way, that we want to walk, that we want to roam freely, and technology makes that increasingly impossible, which is strange to many people, because I would think, you know, the wheel is a kind of a tool. It makes things much easier. It makes it also much easier to travel. Or think of the iPhone and the GPS. It makes it much easier to travel. Is it really true that technology is blocking our way? Is it not just paving new paths?
You see, I don't want to enter into conceptual distinctions, but it's very important to distinguish between technique as a kind of tool and technology. And what it means is that, you know, we need tools. I mean, like I'm using a pen, and so I'm putting down points by my pen, and that's a tool. But even that is a bit ambiguous, because the more I register things, the more I forget it. So if you look into the past, and if you looked into, you know, Homer and Greek rhapsodes, or you look into Serbian popular poets and artists, they remembered, you know, poems which were tens of thousands of words, and they just recounted it because they remembered it. So in a way, simple tools undermine our own abilities. Now, but what I call technology, that's very different, because technology is when, and it's very Heideggerian, but Heidegger was very right in that.
Martin Heidegger, the German philosopher of the 20th century.
And what it means is that, you know, instead of we are using technology, it is technology which is using us increasingly. And with the AI, that's even more the case, because the way AI works is that it takes some models and assumes that it is this model that we are following and imposes that on us. So anybody who doesn't fit the model, who, let's say, is an outlier, even in terms of mathematical statistics, is somebody who is to be eliminated. And that's a sacrificial mechanism on its own. So you have to go with the average.
I see. Well, you could also say with Heidegger that our freedom is framed.
Exactly.
That we are not absolutely free.
Yes. That's the point, yes.
In your project here for the St. Gallen Collegium, you suggested that we should go back to the Greeks and make distinctions concerning freedom that were at the center of the Greek culture. Could you name these three concepts and what they mean for present day liberalism and freedom?
Yes, that's very important because, of course, the Greeks are one of the main sources of our own culture and our own idea of freedom. And the three Greek words in that sense were autonomia, autarkia, and eleutheria. Now, I don't speak or even learn Greek, but my history teacher, who was a teacher in a high school, and this was because he was thrown out of the university. He should have been teaching in university under communism, but for my luck, he was teaching in high school. And these
so
are the
in communism, the best minds had to recede to school and not to university because they were not allowed there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, when I went from my high school to university, it was a very serious drop of standards from my high school because I was in what was considered the best high school in Hungary and it was populated by people who were not allowed to teach at the university. But going back to these three words he taught us as the central words of Greek polis, or we call it democracy, but that's not exactly the way the Greeks called it. But anyway, and these three words could be traced to polybios, as far as I can now make it out. But anyway, they make autonomia. Autonomia is like autonomy, except that autonomia meant etymologically and concretely something like sovereignty, that is the right to give your laws. So polis, the city-states, the polis give their own laws. That was autonomy. Now, autarkia is the strangest for us because autarkia meant independence, kind of independent existence. So you as a polis and every oikos basically had to produce its own living, not to be dependent on others. And eleutheria means freedom in a more broad sense as we mean it.
Let me summarize that. Autonomia, to give a law to yourself, a norm to yourself, and follow that rule.
As a polis, it's very important. It was not an individual.
As a political
Kantian
concept.
Autonomy is a kind of individualized, liberal version of this Greek vision. But the Greek didn't meant that you as a human being give your own laws. And, you know, that doesn't even make any sense. We have to be careful, yes.
Yes, so that would be autonomia in the Greek sense.
Yeah.
Then there's autarkia, and that is a very radical idea of independence in the house and in the state.
Exactly.
And then there's the last one, and that means to roam, to feel, to perceive yourself as a free human being, in contrast to a slave.
Well, that was certainly an important point there, but that's a very delicate point, what exactly meant to be a slave in Greek states, in Rome, and then it has nothing really to do with the later sort of American slavery kind of things, which is a completely different kind of idea, but whatever it means. But yes, so what does it mean to be free? That's the main question, by the way. Yes.
What does it mean to be free? For us now, in our modern societies, freedom is a concept that is applied to the individual, not to communities, not even to societies, but the individual has to be free. That's actually somewhat strange, but it is that way. And then, of course, there are different ways to be free. For example, one way to frame the concept of freedom is, I can do whatever I want. I'm free if I'm able to do that. No one knows what that exactly means, but that's one idea. The second idea is, I become myself. I find my true self, and then I'm free. And the last idea is probably, I'm just being free. I'm not constrained by anyone. Are those really meaningful concepts of freedom to your mind?
Well, in my view, these are problematic views of freedom, but this requires a kind of contextualization of the entire idea of freedom. And here I can only give some ideas about the research, which I'm not doing, so they are very, very provisional. And I would start by saying that we connect this freedom very much to the economy. So individualism and individualist economy, you do whatever you want, you can do your own business, you make contracts with whomever you want. And the basic point, as I see, is that this freedom replaces a kind of living in nature with living inside an economy. And this living inside the economy is part of a general problematization of nature, meaning that we as humans are enslaved to nature. And what we need to do is to liberate ourselves from the slavery from nature. So it's very simple. So another, you know, the sun is shining, but if it is raining, then we need a shelter, isn't it? So we go inside the house, and that is to be free from nature. And now this is very simple insofar as we turn into weather things and other matters. But I think deeply in the modern, whatever you call it, mentality.
Mindset, maybe.
Mindset, there is a hostility to nature. So the basic point is to close out nature as much as possible.
To deny its existence and importance.
Exactly. And then we live inside our own houses and buildings and everything free from nature. The problem is that this makes us a slave to technology, in my reading. And that is a basic problem.
So there's a dialectics. Once you try to free yourself from nature, you become a slave to technology.
It's something like that. Yes, yes.
Interesting.
And so this is why I introduce sort of my approach or my path to freedom is like freedom means living with a degree of freedom. So living free. So like walking free. Then you know, you walk and you are not free to walk anywhere because you are not free to walk on water. Very, very few persons can walk on water. Mm-hmm. Yes. So you are not free to walk anywhere you want, but, you know, there is nature and you know, the nature is really outside us.
So it's kind of a confined freedom, but confined, for example, by the laws of nature, maybe by some traits of the human creature as such. And if I understand you correctly, you think it's part of the problem of the modern mindset that we have enslaved us to technology in order to become free from nature. And both movements are dangerous, and we could even say today, devastating ecologically.
Absolutely. And this is where we turn to reason, which is such an important question anthropologically and philosophically, because reason sort of originally meant to be aware of our own limitations, so like nature. Sort of reasonable life meant that, you know, there is nature around, so you need to know, you need to navigate your way. I mean, you cannot do anything because nature is giving you some trouble about that. And we replace that with rationality, which is not the same thing. I mean, whatever it etymologically is, because by rationality means that, you know, by using the technology and exchanging everything through the economy, then we optimize our supposed well-being and freedom. But it doesn't do that because, again, it enslaves you in a very trivial way to technology.
This is so super and interesting, Arpad. Let me just try to rephrase it. So in English language, there is a difference between being reasonable and being rational, which is very interesting in itself. And you claim that being reasonable is accepting and acknowledging the limits that are given to us by our very existence. Yes. And the rationality is kind of a logic of limitlessness that is embodied today mainly by market logics.
Yes, yes, it's something like that. I mean, of course, rationality is a Latin word, and in Latin it meant something very, very different because it meant ratio, and ratio meant a kind of harmony. So the problem is not with the word, but the problem is what we did with the word, and this is a consequence of a certain kind of liberal economic idea about rationality, and that somehow in this, again, free market, whatever setting, rationally, we can optimize individually, and somehow magically these individual things through the market become and that just doesn't work.
And you see, if you look, for example, at commercials, this idea of limitlessness and possibilities reigning everywhere, it's everywhere. You could say, for example, Toyota says, nothing is impossible. Or if you go now to a hotel, you say, go wherever you want to go. It means for me that the modern mindset or our contemporary mindset is marked by the promise of limitlessness. And therefore, it's highly unreasonable, if I understand you correctly.
Absolutely. That is certainly the case. And this, you know, the logic of the commercials is a very important part of our misunderstanding of ourselves, which is much located in economic theory, because let's not forget that I have a PhD in economics. So I know what economics is talking about. And economics talks about the rational choice, the rational consumer, and information which is available.
It's so strange, you know. There is no reasonable choice theory. There's only a rational choice theory.
Yes, because that word has become so much associated into this type of logic, which is a illogical logic, which is in a way even a kind of perverted logic. I mean, how can anybody say that commercials give rational information to the consumer? This is what economists are saying. I mean, look up your economic theory books. Rational information. Nonsense.
And now I think we already have come a long way to understand why your current project here at the St. Gallen Collegium is named Beyond Liberalism, because the very idea of liberalism and a liberal democracy is linked to certain understandings of what economy is. First of all, a liberal democracy is a democracy, of course, where you have certain institutions, you have human rights, you have a focus on the individual, and you seek, if I understand you correctly, a way out of that impasse that is created by liberalism as we know it.
Yes, one has to be very, very careful with this, because there are many elements of this liberal democratic framework, constitutionalism, and so on, which were developed historically and which are even have much, much older background to that, which is not to be taken lightly and certainly not to be thrown away. But part of this liberal mindset became a series of ideas, and this is a very complex historical process and what the general of liberalism, which have become problematic and which we see it now. It is problematic concerning the very idea of representation. So what do we mean by representation? It's an enormous question of
our democracies are marked by the representational logic, for example.
Exactly, a representation logic. But then if we look into the origin of representation, the origin of representation, the very word is theatrical. And this is, for example, what is continuously being forgotten, that the public sphere means representation, but it also means a kind of theatricality. And that is one of the problems. Then the other problem is this strange kind of individualism, which in one way ignores the cultural, social, community, but then on the other hand, it ignores in a certain way the very personal element of that, because it's a very specific kind of individual which is supposedly represented. And this is important in terms of AI, because the AI is sort of enforces the same statistical average kind of individual. So if you think like anybody else, if you like what anybody else, then you are fine. But the moment in which you don't exactly follow this type of norms and fashions, then you are not suited by the artificial intelligence. If you think like anybody, then you write an email and the thing tells you what you write. But if you don't write that, then it can easily mislead you or gives you the wrong message.
And yet, Arpad, our entire culture is based on the idea stand out, make a difference, be different. It sounds like a quandary, like a paradox of our system.
Yes, it is very paradoxical, but it's a very schismatic in a way. And this is where another anthropological concept is schismogenesis. So how certain schisms...
Bateson, is it true?
Gregory Bateson, a main anthropologist. So how certain schisms are generated and identities are developed around this schism. And our contemporary world is full of this kind of schisms and the schism between the ideals to pursue and what the reality means. The schism between, you know, be brave and stand up for yourself and then being really rewarded. I noticed that when I went to the United States and I was free to basically to select any...
When was that in your life?
That was in 82. Yes. In 82 in Texas.
Before the fall of the wall already.
That was before the fall of the wall, yes. It was a very particular situation from the Academy of Sciences, whatever. But the basic point was that you could select any course, yes. But then if you just selected courses which don't add it up together in the official kind of logic, then you had problems. So it's you were supposed to be free. And then I realized that, wait a minute, this is just like that you have to write in Hungary. So you write in mind of what they expect you that you would write. Because if you just write what you want, then that would have been a problem.
About so many things that I would like to pick on and continue. First of all, you said there's a theatrical element in representation. And again, if we look at present-day politics, it's so obvious. It sometimes seems like a theater, like a charade, even a parody of real politics. And yet we consider this to be politics. Do I get you right when you say the problem with representational democracy is that it has not acknowledged the origin of representation in theater and thereby creates a false image of politics in itself.
Yeah, this is very much the case. And it's very delicate because the idea of political representation was, and there are very, very good books about that. They were medieval and they were theological and aristocratic. That is what it meant in a medieval sense is that it's basically Corpus Christi. So politicians or members are representatives of the body of Christ in some kind.
There's one book by Kantorowicz, who's probably the most important scholar on this.
Hasso Hoffmann, he wrote a very, very good book on that. So that was one part of it. And the second part was it was an election, was an aristocratic part of the aristocratic logic, meaning that you knew people, and so the aristocrats who had the right to do that elected somebody. It's similar a bit in the German, I don't know how this is, whatever is. I know it in Hungarian how it is said that the electorates, whatever, who were the right to elect the emperor. There were only few princes who had this kind of right. So it was there was partly a theological principle of representation, partly an aristocratic principle of election. And somehow these two came into the modern idea of representative politics, but there, this representation incorporated the theatrical idea of rappresentanza.
And everything changed. So by the migration of these concepts through time and space,
yes,
the very logic of democracy changed.
It changed the logic, and this entire entity, you know, medieval, theological, aristocratic election, representation worked until a certain way, until the media started to play an even ever more increasing role, pushing up or as if coming out or resurrecting from underground the theatrical component. I can give you one example about that. I remember that in about 1983, there was a new television station in America called the C-SPAN. Mm-hmm. And the C-SPAN, if I remember well, was...
It
still exists. It was showing how the Congress deliberates.
I love to watch that when I was in the US.
It's a good theater, but you know, that was when it was said that this is an additional step in democracy. I said, no, it's an additional lowering of democracy, because if you are a congressman, then you talk among yourself and you should be entrusted that you discuss the common good. But if it is shown on television, then you become actors and
it
just
becomes
perform.
A stage.
Yeah, it's a stage for you to perform.
But Arpad, here's another contradiction maybe, because what you want in democracy is transparency. You want to have visibility. You want to see what people say, what is talked about and how they decide. And you say, that is a problematic idea because it turns democracy into a theater.
Yes, you know, transparency is another problematic idea. It looks nice, but any serious discussion can only be made among people in a reserved kind of setting. So just to give you one example about that, it's academic setting. So academics should be discussing let's say an appointment or something like that. Now, the central issue, and I'm very stringent on that, is that you have to trust the people who make the decisions. But if you want to check them the moment in which they make the decisions, then you transform academic institutions into a comedy. Now, this happened with me in the first year I was in Ireland, when there was an academic council, and the academic council was only the council of professors. And in the first council I was there, they appointed 5 members of the staff and, I don't know, 5 student representatives, and everybody was loudly, you know, hailing it. And another step, I said, no, this entire entity will no longer exist. And half a year later, they appointed an academic board, which were only some professors were selected and which became the decision-making body instead of academic council. Now, 5 years later, it became the university management team. And when I, as a professor, and at that time was head of department, I was asked, but who is a member of the university management team? I was told, you cannot know that.
Mm-hmm. So it's a new kind of elite.
You cannot. It's a new kind of managerial elite in the name of increasing democracy.
I think we already get a sense of how interesting our present-day politics look when we see it through your lens and the lens of political anthropology. Another idea that we should talk about when we talk about the beyond liberalism aspect of your work is, it seems to be a very timely effort, and not necessarily in a good sense, because there are many political forces right now who say exactly that. We should move beyond liberalism, namely autocratic forces embodied by people like Putin, possibly Orban, possibly even Trump. They say exactly, not exactly what you say, but they say the same thing in the sense that we have to move beyond liberalism. And I would imagine that it's for you very problematic to make clear that you don't mean that.
Yes, to be sure. I mean, one has to be very careful in how to formulate these kind of terms. And at the beginning of what I said, I said that this kind of, you know, constitutional rule and representative institutions, which are problematic enough in themselves, but are still important in the sense that we have to keep to a certain kind of rules of the game and not allowing people to hijack them. But here we come into a very important anthropological, sociological, cultural point, which I think is very central. And this is that when liberal democracies existed in a kind of normal way, they relied not on the media so much, but they relied that there was a kind of, and it's very difficult to say, a kind of cultured classes, which was not, were not elites, not exactly the middle classes. They can be called as, in German, there is a good word about the Bürgertum or something like
maybe
that.
Maybe trustworthy people?
Exactly. And that's the central point. So they were people who could be trusted, who had a degree of culture. And culture doesn't mean that, you know, you read Shakespeare and Molière, which is of course fundamental, because if you read Shakespeare and Molière, you get a different kind of culture than if you
look into... A certain sensitivity.
Yes, yes. And so these people still existed, and this exerted a control, and they exerted a certain control even through the journals, because let's say in the 1970s or 80s, if you read Le Monde or the Zeit or the Times, you know, these were the people who were
or
behind.
Or the NZZ in Switzerland, in Neue Zürcher Zeitung. Yes.
And not, not Well, here we come a very important point about the very idea of the revolution. Because right now, if you turn on the television, it's all about the revolution. All commercials are about the revolution, a new revolutionary, whatever it is, iPod, everything is
disruption, it's now called. It's now called disruption. They are very careful with revolution. The new word is, I think, disruption.
Yes. That's the next step, which is even more problematic, because, of course, disruption means the instrumentalization of liminality, which turns into another anthropological concept. But at any rate, and this is very important, that in my understanding, just at the same time when there was the Cold War, when there were, you know, Bolshevism and communism, there were kind of radical movements which attacked the heart of this cultural elite. Now, it's difficult to reconstruct how that much cultural...
But I can see, and I think it's interesting that you're struggling with even pronouncing the word elite, because
yes,
it has become such a shamed term.
Yes.
But then again, you would hold and actually believe that we need cultural elites. We need
yes,
these trustworthy people, and they are trusted by their communities,
exactly,
if I understand
yes,
you correctly.
Yes. Now, the elite, I have a problem even in the word, because the elite as a word is a religious word, of course. And people who were, you know, called, and so they were elected in that particular sense. And we don't have a word. We cannot call them. We can call them as a kind of cultural aristocracy, but aristocracy has a problematic word in itself. So it's difficult to how to define them. But I knew many of these people still in Hungary, when I was there, in Italy, in the United States. So these people still existed, and they exerted an influence. And this is being undermined. And it's a very tricky and very important question to see how these people came to be undermined. What was the logic of that? Was it the logic of the media? Was the logic of getting ever shallower, but more...
transparency.
Yes, yes.
But Arpad, let's apply this, for example, to this institution, the HSG in St. Gallen, which is and claims to be an elite institution. And even more, they claim to educate the future elite of business leaders. Now, the program of this very university is based on the idea that a good business leader knows more than only business. He is a humanist. He has a broad education. Do you think that if you want to be a trustworthy person in the sense that you envision, it's enough to know of one thing, or would you need a rather broad and humanist approach to things?
Absolutely, one needs a broader and humanistic approach. I was teaching 2 years in a winter school of the Milan Polytechnic, or whatever it is, which was considered to be the elite institution in Italy. And it was an institution training architects, design, and engineers, or something like that. And they realized that they need some kind of humanistic or social science education. Now, as far as I understand, after 2 years, they closed this down. So maybe it was too expensive for them. So it's always a tricky thing. But it's, and I don't know, not to say enough, but hardly anything really about Sangalen and its background. I mean, I'm here since September, but and it's training an elite in our own times. It's a very delicate kind of activity of what we really mean by that.
There's a beautiful saying by Johann Wolfgang von Goethe. I know someone who is very close to your heart and your mind. He says, "The one who knows only about one thing doesn't know anything about that one thing either." And I think this is an idea of what it means to be educated, that if you're an absolute specialist, you're already also very bad at your speciality, because there are no specialities in a complex world.
Absolutely. I mean, today we are talking about always about the experts, and that's a very problematic word. My series is now publishing a book about experts by Paul O'Connor and Stephen Turner, who's a very important social theorist in our times. He wrote several books about the problem of an expert, because really, in almost anything except an extremely technical kind of matter, and in the human sciences and the world of human beings, nothing is unconnected. So an expert is a way to promote ignorance, really.
And that takes us to university culture of nowadays. I know you're very critical of that culture, and who cannot be, who has seen what happens inside a university. Would it be fair then to say, and I'm putting these words into your mouth, maybe they are mine, that current days universities create experts and therefore idiots, which are all too specialized?
Yeah, that's a very important word. It's interesting that I hear this and read this word increasingly. And a few years ago, I was reprimanded of using that word, idiot. Now, interestingly, idiot has a Greek etymology, which is basically the same as we think about idiosyncrasy. So the idiotes in the Greek meant a purely private man who has no understanding of the broader situation of the
Doesn't care. That's
community.
An idiot.
Yes. And I would agree that the experts in the human worlds are some kind of, I don't want to repeat the word, but they are, because they are extremely narrow and they promote this narrow field. And what is now happening in university life, all around in publications, promotions, is really very, very disheartening, because it's the undermining of the university, which after all is university means is universal kind of knowledge.
And it's also undermining democracy at the same time, because we create these experts who are specialists. And of course, they get promoted because they do research on one topic. And they write 10, 15 articles on one topic.
Yes.
And that qualifies them for a post. And I mean, it's so obvious that this is a catastrophe that one wonders why the system doesn't change.
Well, yes, that is that we go into the heart of the problem, because I think this is promoted exactly because it promotes ignorance. And this is a new situation. And this new situation is that we are now increasingly ruled by people. And it's not just, Trump and this kind of the usual candidates, but it goes into almost everywhere, which don't want people around who think. And that's a very dangerous kind of situation, because there is no way that those who promote this straitjacketing of university life, that this undermines any kind of knowledge and culture and understanding. So this is done purposefully. Why? I don't know.
Let's maybe try to connect that with your own biography. You have a very critical view on the culture that we live in. You lived under two fundamentally different systems. You grew up in Hungary under communist rule. You then migrated, one could say, or being exiled to the US, doing your PhD there. And anyway, you took the decision to leave Hungary. You were educated in economy. And then, of course, I would imagine that you created a certain sensitivity toward the concept of freedom, because even under communist rule, it was claimed that we live in the freest society ever. And then you come to Texas, supposedly a state that cares about freedom, and there was also total freedom. So one might get a bit suspicious biographically, wouldn't one?
Yes, yes. But of course, when I was living in Hungary, the question of freedom was very fundamental, and there was evidently no freedom. Then I went to Texas. I still have a Hungarian passport, so I wasn't exiled. It was a complex the details are so complicated, and we don't have time for that. But I was very, you know, surprised about many elements of American culture and, you know, the complexities of freedom. Then I went back to Hungary. Then I went back to London, and I lived 1 year after the last year of Margaret Thatcher's rule, which was also very interesting in
terms of...
A kind of freedom agenda. So was it freedom? Was it not about freedom? Then I lived in Italy. So this is why I try to really capture... In this book, which I'm writing about, what is really the heart of a meaningful idea of freedom. And there I have to mention one particular word, that is charis. And this is another Greek word, charis.
What does it mean?
Charis means Greece, and they are very close to each other. In fact, Greece, the English word, is a derivative of the Greek word charis, but charis meant something different than Greece. It was less focused on, because grace in English means either is divine grace, so it is strictly theological, or there is grace connected to beauty and cosmetics, so it's a very specifically limited just the beauty component.
Hemingway famously said, beauty is grace under pressure.
Yes, it can be, but you know, it was also said that beauty is truth and truth beauty, and that's Keats, and Dostoevsky said beauty would save the world. So it's, you know, even beauty is a very complex word, and we cannot reduce beauty to its commercialization, because then we reduce liberalism and freedom.
Let's stay with charis. So
let's stay with charis, absolutely. So charis meant both the divine, for the Greeks, it had a divine component, it had an aesthetical, if you want, component, but it also had a social component, which for me as an anthropologist, and charis meant basically a kind of kind benevolence or favor. So charis meant in a fundamental trust and benevolence to the others as the foundation of the polity. Because the Greek democracy was based on charis, justice was based on friendship. And there's a good literature on that up to Aristotle, that friendship or philia, and philia is broader than friendship, is the foundation of polis.
Isn't that a bit of a Christian view on charis? It's like love thy neighbor?
It is very similar, and of course, but it's Greek. So it was pre-Christian. Of course, the Christian element relies much on the Greek culture, as much it as relies on the prophetic culture. It doesn't rely on the sacrificial priestly culture. But it's a very important difference.
So for not only, but also biographical reasons, you have created for yourself a certain sensitivity against ideological uses of the concept of freedom and liberty. And you think right now, am I putting this correctly, that this concept has been culturally hijacked at the present time?
You mean freedom?
Yes.
I mean, yeah, freedom has been hijacked since a long time in many different kind of ways. And ideology and propaganda are very, very important considerations here. So how can freedom be an element of propaganda? And this goes into the origins of much of the current ruling, if you want, political ideologies. For example, it can be traced back to Walter Lippmann. Walter Lippmann was an American political scientist who basically in the 1920s and in the 30s was saying that it is legitimate to use propaganda to salvage democracy. And that was a very, very problematic idea already at that time.
He had also a hand in creating the concept of neoliberalism, did he?
Lippmann, absolutely. I mean, the Mont Pelerin Society was based on the meetings related to Walter Lippmann. So there are all kinds of obscure connections there, just as in terms of propaganda, there are obscure connections between late 19th century American business propaganda, First World War propaganda, Stalinist propaganda, Goebbels propaganda, this stuff, all circling around themselves. And all these propagandas were supposedly that, you know, we can lie if in the interest of the common good, whatever way it is defined.
Is it too simple to claim that one of the main tasks of the humanities and the social sciences is to make us aware of the effects and the power of propaganda, that we, as it were, sharpen our ears, and that the humanities are in that business?
That is absolutely fundamental, and that can be one of the reasons why thinking is now being, in a very serious sense, demoted, because what is now happening to academic life is extremely problematic. For example, I was in England in the late 1980s, and I could still see and experience how academic life functioned there until it was being really systematically destroyed in several different kinds of
things. In the names of market logic.
In the name of market logic, or in the names of, I don't know whether it was in the name of freedom, but in the name of maybe just a market logic kind of freedom, or efficiency, or greater transparency. I don't know what exactly, because these words travel, ideological words travel very... And, you know, it's interesting because we haven't yet mentioned Michel Foucault.
Mm-hmm. A French historian and philosopher.
And philosopher, very important philosopher. And Michel Foucault, in some of his last interviews in the early 1980s, was very much saying that, you know, freedom is very important, but freedom is something which has to be exerted. It cannot be, it can be ideologically, neutralized or turned into an ideology. It can be. Everything can be into an ideology. But we have to somehow again live freedom. That's not what he said, but practice freedom, and that is what is fundamental.
Let's turn to give our listeners a sense of how broad your interests are and how specific they are at the same time to the idea of the rise of capitalism, because it's a hallmark of modern societies, liberal societies, that we address them as capitalistic societies. It means basically that you're allowed to own things, that there's a kind of competition, and that you have to be able to keep the gains of that competition for yourself. Say this is the framework, more or less. And you say we understand capitalism poorly if we think that markets are the origins of capitalism. You think there's a different origin. Which one?
Yes, thank you. Yeah, I don't like the word capitalism, many of these words, because capitalism is associated with a particular reading, which is, of course, Marx, and I don't have a great respect or interest in Marx. But very specifically, I can say that the idea that capitalism is connected to markets, it's there in Ricardo, and Marx basically takes over Ricardo, making a few
That's
changes.
That's 18th century economic theory, if I'm correct.
Ricardo is early 19th century, 1819 is Principles of Political Economy. And the problem is that the modern economy didn't grow out of markets, but grew out of fairs, or the frère grand.
Like the Olma here in St. Gallen, for
example.
It's
something like that. This is a simple fact of economic history, which has been ignored in the history of economics. And I think that's a fundamental misunderstanding, because a fair is something very different from a market. So let's just... In terms of knowledge.
Explain the difference. I think it's very important.
Yeah, in terms of knowledge, if you go into a market, then a market is a local market, which basically every town had a market, which extended to 10, 20 kilometers or miles. People came to the same market, knew the people.
You know the seller, you know the products.
Buyers and sellers knew each other, knew the products, knew who is producing what and how and whatever. So this was an informed, if you want, rational decision. A fair is something completely different. A fair is something once in a year. I think in German it's called Jahrmarkt.
Yes. So it's a yearly market. Book fair, for example, in Frankfurt. This is the place where you do irrational things.
Absolutely. So it's only once in a year. It's connected with the carnival, for example. It is a popular entertainment.
Circus has come to town.
Circus is coming to town. And then you don't know anybody. You go there, people are shooting or whatever. You buy this or that. This is where historically the charlatans were there. They were selling products, alchemy. Dr. Faustus is located to the fair, and alchemy, and elixir, you get eternal life if you buy it.
So the difference is, in a market, you know the seller and you know the quality of the products. In a fair, strangers come to town and claim that they have super products, and they create an atmosphere of irrationality where everything is possible.
Yes, and then it goes into, it's all about advertisement, it's about pamphlets connected to the rise of the printing press, connected about mimes. The origin of the theater is charlatans who were organizing the mimes first to advertise the products and then became the first theater company, Commedia dell'arte, Venice. It all makes sense. It is all connected.
It's fascinating.
And that's a fair. And the fair is becoming longer and longer and more permanent. And then what comes into it? We arrive at the stock market. And here we are at the origin of capitalism in that it's a stock market. It's not markets. It's a stock market.
And the stock market is an embodiment of what you call permanent carnival or permanent liminality. It means it's an eternal fair that is designed to make irrational decisions.
But it's something like, of course, we all know that because going up and down, what you buy, what you don't buy, and even economists know that because, for example, Paul Samuelson, who is one of the most famous economists, wrote in the late 1940s an article, and that was before he got the Nobel Prize, and he was saying that, I mean, we are talking about the marginal efficiency of capital and all these kind of things, and justifying that it is, but how can you justify somebody making $100,000 just because he's selling 2 minutes earlier than the others. So there is no justification really in ethical terms on that. It's just going up and down. And then
you could also say it's a perverted market. To be a bit more explicit.
In terms of when we talk about market in the classical sense, it is. And it's getting more and more, if you want, perverted, more and more interconnected artificially. And more we are moved by how the stock market is moving.
But Arpad, if that is true, what you say, and I think it's fascinating, it's also plausible. If you look at the London Stock Exchange or the Wall Street, it really looks much more like a fair than like a market nowadays. But our models and our theories to address that event are theories of rational choice. And one could have the idea it's a radical misinterpretation of what's actually going on.
Yes, well, this is very interesting because when I was studying in Texas economics, that's when rational expectation theory came out, in contrast to Keynesian theory. Now, this is not the time to make a lecture on economics, but just the important point about that rational expectation theory, which is the origin of rational choice theory, says that the government is inefficient in any kind of economic policy because people have the same information as the government as they are rational consumers. Now, this is a kind of nonsense, sort of codified, and these people got a bunch of Nobel Prizes when, you have your theory that, really the market is based on rational information, and then your theory then guides your ideas instead of looking at that and, how can somebody say that we have the same information as the government? We don't have. So the thing, and my economist professors who were Keynesian at that time said the same thing, but they lost.
I think we have established by now something that is true of every true thinker, that you are a radical guy, because you are radically questioning the logics of our society as it exists, and you would like them to see changed. Changed how?
Yeah, I agree with that, except that I'm also radically conservative in that sense, because
but
I'm radical.
It's a form of radicalism.
It's a form of radicalism in the sense that we have to go back to the roots insofar as they are meaningful. And that's what radical means.
Radix. So, back to the roots, it sounds like something that cannot be done because we're moving forward in time and not backward.
Yes.
What is, for you, the beginning of healing this culture and make it more reasonable when we have to start from now and not looking back but looking forward?
We have to do both at the same time. That is very important because, again, I go back to walking and pilgrimage because when we were walking, we often lost the road. And then what we realize is that if somebody is losing the road when walking, you have to go back when you miss the road. You cannot just make a shortcut because you can get even more confused and lost.
But if you're in a maze and you go back all of the time, you're running in circuits.
Well, you have to leave the maze then. So, but anyway, so I agree with you. And, the point is not to go back in time in the sense that we have to go back to the 16th century or the 14th or whatever. That is impossible. But it's interesting that being here and the origins of the Reformation wanted to go back to the evangelical ways. And they didn't really succeed, to put it mildly. And so we have to look forward, but also in a certain way going back, and we should try to find what can be meaningfully recovered or preserved in this world in which we are living. And we have to, you know, take these many of these concepts like nature, like freedom, like charis, you know, daily interaction of real people and not letting something to be done by artificial intelligence. For example, for me, if something can be done efficiently by artificial intelligence, it means that there's something wrong with it.
Because you don't have to think to solve the problem.
Yeah, and it's not just the thinking, but you don't have to feel. I mean, imagine, you know, anything in our life which is meaningful links to, you know, our children and our friends. You know, artificial intelligence doesn't do anything with that, cannot.
So one critique of artificial intelligence for you would be that it is problem solving without feelings.
Absolutely, and you can even mimic feelings, but it's the mimicking of feelings make as much sense as mimicking reason, because it is just guided by the law of large numbers. My background is probability theory, so I know. And the law of large numbers, you know, it works, but it only works in a very particular kind of way, which leads into a dead-end street of a maze.
Trying to leave the maze to find the Ausgang, the exit. That's what Kant said philosophy should do, what Enlightenment should do. Maybe we start with feelings and a personal question to you. When do you feel free? Experience yourself as a free human being?
That's a very good question again. And it leads into a central term of my thinking, which is the heart. And the heart, I mean, for example, in the sense of Pascal. And in the Pascal
Blaise
was
Pascal,
a,
you mean?
Blaise Pascal, a contemporary of Descartes and a great philosopher. And by the way, Pascal said about Descartes three words, inutile et incertain.
Useless and wrong.
Useless and uncertain.
Yes.
Wrong. So don't worry about Descartes. And Pascal said, the heart has its reasons, which reason cannot understand. A reason at that time was already the Cartesian reason, so the reason of rationality. And so the reason means not simply emotion, but the reason means a kind of fundamental center of one's own existence, which guides feelings and guides also one's mind.
I think we should take that message to heart, as one says, to really embody it, to feel its power. I mean, I know that you recently got a dog that you're very fond of, and the dog is with you here in St. Gallen. When I think of freedom, really, my image is that I see a dog without a leash running through a meadow and being extremely happy of being free and roaming freely. And that would mean that also animals can be free and feel free.
That's even more than that, because in dogs do something which you certainly remember when they are free, that they start to be ecstatic. It means that they are not just running after a fox or something, they just run up and down as crazy. And this is what you know, ecstasy means, and which is a kind of excess of freedom. And of course, not everything in the name of ecstasy is real freedom.
I think we can close the circle now, because that ecstasy is a good ecstasy. It's the ecstasy of freedom, but it's not an internal carnival. It happens only in certain times, at certain times, in certain periods.
Absolutely.
And then you have to come back, as it were, to normality.
Absolutely. That's again the point, that all this sort of eternal or permanent carnival liminality that we are living, it certainly this has to stop. And we can see it really everywhere, how this sort of limitless expansion of a certain kind of way of life everywhere is increasingly meaningless, because you cannot live all the time in a particular state of excitation.
And what about thinking? Do you feel free when you think? Because you are a thinker.
The interesting thing here is that thinking has a certain similarities to dreaming. In the sense that when we think, you know, who really does the thing, or what does it mean that we think? You know, neurophysiologists and whatever try to claim there's certain neurons in our mind that connect. I think that's the other way around. But we don't know how we think. And for example, walking is very important for thinking. Mm. But that's when we are free when we walk, and whenever I have a problem in continuing. I always walk out of my office and start working, which in a certain HR logic is illegal. Luckily, I'm not under that. Why do you leave your office? That shows how this is nonsensical.
So let the thoughts and the people roam freely to the face of the earth to make them think.
Well, yeah, let's work and roam freely. That's, but
it's too much already.
It's a bit too much, but we should certainly think, we should certainly work. And then again, when we think, who is that we think? So it's what is the origin of our ideas? Nobody knows that.
Nobody knows that, but we can ask one thing that we should know. And that's the last question in this podcast always, which is called No Mustard, Ohne Senf. If you were, and I know you have, if you were to eat a sausage in St. Gallen, would you eat it with or without mustard?
Oh, well, I have a very simple answer to that. And this, I became allergic to mustard when I was in Texas. I don't know why, but since then I cannot eat mustard. So if I eat mustard for 3 days, my mouth is, as mustard allergy does, insensitive. So I eat without mustard.
So you have come to the right place. Thank you so much, Arpad, for sharing your thoughts with us.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
That was No Mustard, the knowledge podcast by the St. Gallen Collegium.